log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today's great tip, what are the secrets of believing in what you say? And the enhancement and strengthening of our ubudiyya, our servitude to Allah.
Allah, Allah, Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So, dear listeners, when we're talking about believing in what we say, of course, this is something that seems to just roll off our tongues. To believe in what you say. But in reality, this statement is quite profound. We find that truly believing in what you say makes a world of difference when it comes to our ubudiyya, our servitude to Allah, our obedience to Allah, and our worship of Allah the Almighty. Now, of course, it's very easy to say, La ilaha illallah. There is no God but Allah. But to truly believe in this statement, perhaps it might take a lifetime. Now, of course, we have different levels of belief. So, for example, on a very superficial level, yes, we all believe that there is no God, there is no deity other than Allah, the Almighty, the Exalted. But the more you go towards the certainty and the yaqeen and the certainty again of this statement, and we truly start to believe what we are saying, we will of course see that our ubudiyya will become greatly enhanced and greatly maximized via this means. And so we find that, for example, even the name of Allah the Exalted and the seal of the prophets, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, the noble religion of Islam, the divine sacred book, the Holy Quran, the imams of guidance, and other knowledge and ma'rifah which have not been conveyed to our heart. Meaning, we have not believed in the depths of our heart. These things, such as even the name of Allah and the name of the Holy Prophet and the religion of Islam and the Quran and the Imams, divinely guided Imams, if we do not find them in our heart and we do not have them deeply in our heart, they will surely be forgotten. And they will be forgotten not just in this life, but they will be forgotten when we pass on to the next life.
Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya
Mannan. IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Ya Allah, Ya Rahman, haqqiq amanna.
أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Khaifin, the Whispered Prayer of the Fearful. Please stay with me.
أنا العبد الفقير وأنا أعيش وصاحب القلق نهاري دونكم ليل وليلي كله أنا العبد الفقير وأنا.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, what thinkest you? Will you chastise me after my faith in you? Drive me far away after my love for you? Deprive me while I hope for your mercy and forgiveness? Forsake me while I seek sanctuary in your pardon? How could your generous face disappoint me? I wish that I know. Did my mother bear me for wretchedness? Did she nurture me for suffering? If such, then I wish that she had not borne me and had not nurtured me. I wish that I had knowledge. Have you appointed me one of the people of felicity? Have you singled me out for your nearness and neighborhood? Then would my eyes be gladdened, and in that my soul reach serenity.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. In continuation to what we were saying as far as the secrets of believing in what we say, and when we believe in what we say, we end up enhancing and increasing and strengthening and really maximizing our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah. We said that if certain things do not penetrate into the depths of our heart and our soul, even if they are things as simple as the name of Allah and the name of the seal of the prophets, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and the name of the noble religion of Islam, and even the name of the Quran, and even the names of the divinely appointed imams of the household of the Holy Prophet, and other kinds of knowledge and ma'rifah, if they have not penetrated into the depths of our heart and our soul, they will be forgotten. And not only will they be forgotten in this world, but when we pass on to the next world, they will be forgotten as well. And is this not the case? For example, if we do not firmly believe in something, even if it is something like La ilaha illallah, the kalima, there is no God but Allah, if we don't firmly believe it, then we will forget it. Not just in terms of our tongue and our minds or our memory, but in terms of it being in our hearts. Our heart will forget this. And it will forget it to an extent where even when we are questioned in the grave, we won't be able to answer. Right? The grave is supposed to be a situation which is stressful. It is scary. It is frightening. Right? Because we are being transferred from one realm to another realm. And amongst this fear and this stress and this anxiety and this tension, of course, things that have not penetrated deep into our hearts and our souls, we won't be able to answer. The talqeen, which is the recitation of this remembrance of the name of Allah and the name of the Prophet and the name of the Quran and the name of the Imams, etc., this recitation of the talqeen will be of no avail to us, because we won't find any trace in our heart of the truth of Allah's rububiyyah, His Lordship, or the truth of nubuwa, prophethood, or any other knowledge in ma'rifah which we have acquired. But we merely used to talk about these things, and we had no real image of these concepts and these truths deep in our heart, and thus they will vanish from our memory, and we will be left empty-handed. And so truly, we must slowly but surely believe truly in what we say in order to enhance and strengthen our ubudiyah, our obedience and our servitude to Allah.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
There are many beautiful, beautiful promises of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the mu'mineen and mu'minat. In order to be considered mu'min and a believer according to the Quran, we have to have intellectual conviction that Islam is the truth. It's not a religion that I'm following because of my forefathers or anybody else. I personally am convinced this is Islam, this is the truth. In order to be considered mu'min is that, different than other faiths, it's not going to be a religion where my iman or my faith is only in my heart. The Quran specifies and teaches us that if you are mu'min in Islam, that iman is going to demonstrate itself in our actions. Islam is not a buffet. It's a package deal. Someone who is a Muslim has intellectual conviction that the Quran is the book of God, that Imam Ali is really the first imam. This person has to embrace all of Islam. Picking and choosing in Islam does not lead one to be considered mu'min, and the promises of God are not for those who are not mu'mineen. So, back to the topic. The topic is that God, the creator of the universe, has confidence in you and I. Some of us might not think of ourselves as a champion, as someone who's a game changer, but what's important is how God views us. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And by the way, sisters, this promise that I'm going to share you the verse of Quran with you, this promise that we're going to be sharing and inshallah pondering on and then taking benefit from, is a promise which means no matter what the challenge in life I've been given, Allah has confidence in. It might be dealing with family. Sometimes people have marital issues. Sometimes their children are not doing what they would like. Sometimes their spouse, sometimes relatives. That might be one challenge. It might be a personal challenge. Sometimes someone is a mu'min or mu'mina, maybe not in this community, but it happens. Somebody's even dealing with something as like addiction, be a personal struggle that the person is going through. Sometimes it might be financial issues. You'd be surprised, inshallah, all of you are doing very well financially. Sometimes for mu'mineen and mu'minat, the struggles they're going through, they can't even explain to you and I. Sometimes people are going through financial issues. Sometimes it's a lawsuit. They look on the other side of the equation, on the other side of the table. The enemy seems so powerful. Those who are after them are so strong. But again, Allah believes in me. I can do it. I'm up to the task. It might be long-term health issues.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
سوى الله فوض الأمر لله لله قل ونادي حسبي الله قل فما خاب عبد دعا الله الله لا إله سواه لا تخالطه الظنون ولا العيون تراه الله جل في علاه هو أنسي وملاذي أحتمي بحماه حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله حسبنا الله حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل حسبنا الله
In the limelight. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing a backlash from Conservative MPs after allies briefed that the Prime Minister had won over his party, as splits appear in the One Nation group of Tory centrists about how to proceed. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled, Boris Johnson faces backlash from angry Tory MPs over party scandal. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing a backlash from Conservative MPs after allies briefed that the Prime Minister had won over his party, as splits appear in the One Nation group of Tory centrists about how to proceed. On Tuesday, 1st of February, the veteran MP Peter Aldous said he had submitted a letter of no confidence, and MP Tom Hunt criticised the cack-handed backers of the Prime Minister, though stopped short of saying he should resign. Gary Streeter, the MP for South West Devon, also declined to say he had confidence in the Prime Minister. It is understood Boris Johnson saw at least four former ministers late on Monday night, after at least three others told him their support was either lost or conditional on Sue Gray's final report on Downing Street's lockdown breaches, now being investigated by police. Senior Conservative MP Peter Aldous became the latest MP to say he had written a letter of no confidence in Boris Johnson. After a great deal of soul-searching, I have reached the conclusion that the Prime Minister should resign, Aldous tweeted. I have never taken such action before and had hoped that I would not be put in such an invidious position. Whilst I am conscious that others will disagree with me, I believe that this is in the best interest of the country, the government and the Conservative Party. Charles Walker, the vice chair of the 1922 Committee of Tory Backbenchers, added his voice to the mix, saying he would applaud Johnson for resigning. I think there's so much grief and pain out there that if he was to say that he would resign, that would show great courage, he told Channel 4 News. I would applaud him for doing that, but that is his decision. Elliot Colburn, MP for Carshalton and Wallington, also revealed to a constituent that his patience has now snapped with Boris Johnson and the Partygate scandal, in a hint that he could be among those to have put in a letter. If I were the Prime Minister, I'd be considering my position, Elliot Colburn said. Gary Streeter, the MP for South West Devon, said it was not true the Prime Minister's meeting with MPs had been well received on Monday evening. "This one is not over yet," he told BBC Radio Devon. "It has got legs. A lot of us are thinking very seriously about what we should do about it. It's a serious matter, of course, to express no confidence in a Prime Minister. I'm reflecting, and certainly over the next couple of days, we'll make a decision." Meanwhile, Boris Johnson's critics have admitted there was no plan and no coordination among those who believed the Prime Minister should go. One senior MP, who has been publicly critical of Johnson, said they had been aghast at colleagues' response to the Prime Minister's private meeting with his MPs on Monday night. "The Tory party's reputation for ruthlessness is a complete lie. It's actually never been true, and we're seeing it happening before our eyes," the MP said. One former minister who said they were among a number of colleagues prepared to move as a collective after the Sue Gray report described it as a deeply unwelcome delay, but said they still held the view that a no-confidence vote would have a greater chance of success once the full evidence had been disclosed. But another former cabinet minister who has seen Boris Johnson said the idea of a leadership contest was filling people with horror about the damage that in itself could do to the party. "We would be on our fourth prime minister. What does that say about the party? For better or for worse, we did throw out our lot in with him and we won a big majority." But the MP said that would change if Johnson was fined by the Metropolitan Police. "He's not out of the woods, no. He'd be very foolish to have a mission accomplished banner. At the point where he has committed a criminal offence, of course that changes things, and it depends how bad is the final Sue Gray report." Among those who have expressed anger and frustration are some of the more critical 2019 MPs, who have privately told more experienced colleagues they feel betrayed. Tom Hunt has said the limited findings made in Sue Gray's update were not acceptable, excusable, or defensible, but stopped short of saying it meant he had submitted a letter of no confidence. The MP for Ipswich said some of the interventions by Boris Johnson's allies had been so cack-handed that the best way they could be of assistance to the Prime Minister would be to disable all their social media platforms and cease carrying out media interviews. "Silence would be preferable," he said. Tom Hunt, the MP for Ipswich, said it was not the time to depose the Prime Minister, but that a line could not be drawn under the saga until the full report by senior civil servant Sue Gray was published.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Imam Khomeini and his personal life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about some of the aspects of the personal life of Imam Khomeini and to see how he used to live, how he was in his personal life. We can see that from his children, from his daughters and the sons, we have many things which are said. And even from his wife, there are many things which are said which shows us how he was in his personal life. It is very clear that Imam Khomeini was loving his wife and he paid attention to his kids. Even his daughter said that when there was a time to study and if I would spend more time in studying, he used to stop me and he used to say, there is a time for entertainment and there is a time for study. Do not mix these two times with each other. You should do everything on its own time. On the other hand, she says that once my mother was ill and he used to have tea in the courtyard. Therefore, my mother used to bring tea at a specific place in the courtyard. On the day when she was sick, I changed that place and I put the tea in some other place. When Imam Khomeini came to the courtyard, he said to me, "Why did you change the place where your mother used to put the tea? And I will take tea at the same place. Do not change the things in the way your mother has put it." Therefore, it shows the respect of wife and it shows the respect of the family members within the family in the life of Imam Khomeini.
Congratulations to all Muslims across the world on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Listen to our special programs on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the life of Imam Khomeini and his personal life. Now, in his personal life, when we look at the different aspects of his life, we can see that once his wife said that Imam Khomeini was loving his wife and he used to respect his wife a lot. And she said that in the beginning of our life, Imam Khomeini has said to me that I do not have to do anything with you. I do not stop you from doing anything. And you can wear the clothes the way you want. You can go wherever you want. But remember, do not go towards the guna. And do not perform the forbidden things. If you are performing the allowable things only, the wajibat only, the permissible things, and if you are doing everything within the boundaries of Islam, that is enough for me. I even don't want you to do mustahabbat, which is something extraordinary. So what I expect you is to, the minimum expectation of me from you is to just do what Islam says and do not perform any guna. And this is my expectation from you. And she says that he never stopped her from doing anything because she was taking care of the wajibat. She was not performing any forbidden things. And therefore she said, we had a very happy life. Even if I wanted to go and visit my friends, or if my friends were visiting me, he never stopped me. He never stopped me. And on the other hand, I never stopped him or became a hurdle in the way of learning and teaching. So this shows us the love of a couple which is being shown in the life of Imam Khomeini. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allah, 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 Allah.
إن الذين قالوا ربنا الله ثم استقاموا تتنزل عليهم الملائكة.
Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allah, Allah,
Allah,
la ilaha illallah,
in the limelight.
According to recent revelations, former U.S. President Donald Trump thinks his own Vice President Mike Pence should be investigated by the committee investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol for failing to reject Electoral College results on that fateful day. We have prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Trump tore up records turned over to House Capitol Attack Committee. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The National Archives said some of the White House records turned over to the House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack were ripped up by former U.S. President Donald Trump. It also emerged on Tuesday, 1st of February, that the former president thinks his own Vice President Mike Pence should be investigated by the committee for failing to reject Electoral College results on that fateful day. Documents obtained by the 6th of January panel include diaries, schedules, handwritten notes, speeches, and remarks. The Supreme Court rejected Donald Trump's attempt to stop the National Archives turning them over to Congress. In a statement, the National Archives said, some of the Trump presidential records received by the National Archives and Records Administration included paper records that had been torn up by former President Donald Trump. The National Archives added, these were turned over to the National Archives at the end of the Trump administration, along with a number of torn-up records that had not been reconstructed by the White House. The Presidential Records Act requires that all records created by presidents be turned over to the National Archives at the end of their administrations. The archives did not say how it knew Trump had torn the records, but his habit of tearing up documents has been widely reported. In 2018, the website Politico spoke to Solomon Larty, a records management analyst who spent time armed with rolls of clear scotch tape, sifting through large piles of paper and putting them back together like a jigsaw puzzle. They said summarily, Solomon Larty and another staffer who taped records were fired by the White House that year. Larty said, they told Donald Trump to stop doing it. He didn't want to stop. After a process that reached the Supreme Court, the National Archives gave more than 700 documents concerning the Capitol attack to the House Committee recently. More than 700 people have been charged over the riot, in which Donald Trump's supporters tried to stop certification of his election defeat. 11 members of a far-right militia group are charged with seditious conspiracy. More than 100 police officers were injured on that day. 7 people died. The committee has recommended criminal charges for 2 Trump associates, the former White House strategist Steve Bannon and Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Steve Bannon refused cooperation and pleaded not guilty to contempt of Congress. Mark Meadows cooperated, then withdrew his support. He has not been charged. In a surprise statement on Tuesday, 1st of February, Donald Trump said he thought Mike Pence should be subject to the committee's attentions. He said his vice president should be investigated because he did not send back the votes for recertification or approval, in that it has now been shown that he clearly had the right to do so. Mike Pence concluded that he did not have the right to reject Electoral College results and resisted pressure from Donald Trump to do so. He was rewarded with the attentions of the mob that stormed the Capitol building, some chanting for him to be hanged. Donald Trump has seized on moves in the Senate to reform the Electoral Count Act of 1887, mainly by removing ambiguity over the vice president's role. Constitutional scholars agree the vice president does not have the right to reject results, even under the act as written. Mark Short and Greg Jacob, close aides to Mike Pence, have reportedly spoken to the 6th of January committee recently. Both men were present at an infamous Oval Office meeting on 4th of January 2021, when John Eastman, a constitutional scholar, tried to convince Mike Pence he could reject Electoral College results. Regarding the torn-up White House materials turned over to the committee, Stephen Gillers, a New York University law professor, told the Washington Post destroying White House documents could be a crime under several statutes that make it a crime to destroy government property, if that was the intent of the defendant. Stephen Gillers said, "A president does not own the records generated by his own administration. The definition of a presidential record is broad. Trump's own notes of himself could qualify, and destroying them could be the criminal destruction of government property." Donald Trump did not comment on the National Archives statement, nor did the House Committee. It was also reported on Tuesday, 1st of February, that text messages were turned over to the House Committee by Kayleigh McEnany, Donald Trump's last press secretary. ABC News reported that Kayleigh McEnany appeared before the investigators on 13th of January. It also said the texts were the source of conversations with the Fox News host Sean Hannity, which were quoted by the committee in a request for information from Ivanka Trump, the former president's daughter, an advisor. Sean Hannity texted Kayleigh McEnany after the Capitol attack. 1. No more stolen election talk. Referring to possible attempts to remove Trump from power, he added, 2. Yes, impeachment and the 25th Amendment are real and many people will quit. McEnany replied, "Love that. Thank you. That is the playbook. I will help reinforce." Donald Trump was impeached but acquitted. The 25th Amendment, which provides for the removal of a president incapable of fulfilling his or her duties, was not invoked. Donald Trump continues to claim the election was stolen. McEnany is now a Fox News host. She and her employer did not comment. One former Trump White House insider told The Guardian, "She's an honest woman."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
The January 9th uprising was a brilliant combination of zeal and rationality. The event of January 9th was an example. The event of January 9th in the year 1978 was the same. At that time, too, there was a big threat that lasted several months, but the people's zeal brought them into the arena on the 9th of January and put an end to the threat and any ill effects it may have had. Their zeal turned that threat into an opportunity. So one point is that the religious zeal of the people had been the main factor in these achievements and in turning threats into opportunities. This should be preserved. Speakers, writers, and those who can influence the people's thinking should pay attention to this point. Of course, it is evident that the opponents and enemies will be busy in this regard. They will question the statements that I have made today, but the truth is this. The truth is that religious zeal should be preserved in the people, and by God's grace it will be preserved.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The second point I wish to raise is that you must pay attention to the fact that one of the things that is very serious in the plots formulated by the enemies of the religious and Islamic Republic is their plan to eliminate sensitivity about the principles and foundations of the revolution. The people are sensitive about the fundamental principles of the revolution, and they refute those who question these principles. However, the enemies wish to gradually undermine this sensitivity. They are attempting to do this using the vast propaganda that is being spread through the internet and in the foreign media in one way or another. Sometimes they highlight and magnify the viewpoints of people who are not of much value, neither their comments nor their ideas. There are some people who have a limited intellectual capacity, and they make extravagant claims and question the principles and foundations of the revolution. One important principle of the revolution is the authority of religion. The Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution was essentially established for the sake of the authority of God's religion. They were established to help society have a religious form and a religious geometry. They were established to help the government take on a religious geometry and to move forward accordingly. This was one of the clear principles of the revolution. The people laid down their lives and offered their blood for this to come about. This authority of religion is one of the principles of the religion, but they are undermining this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Food and energy prices are soaring across the 19-nation eurozone, placing enormous pressures on cash-strapped consumers. Inflation hit a record high of 5.1% in January. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Wednesday.
I'm highly concerned about the combination of high and increasing levels of inflation and a central bank that refuses to normalize its monetary policy.
The story is not the same everywhere. For example, Belgium has an inflation rate of 8%. In France, it's just 2.5%.
Hence, we will see divergence in international competitiveness of the member states of the euro area. We've seen in the past the misery that comes about when you have that kind of development.
The economic impact of COVID-19 has disproportionately hit young adults in the EU. Homelessness and mental health problems are rife. For example, here in Belgium, PreventSuicide.be published a report on Tuesday showing calls to its helpline have skyrocketed. A record 22,000 were made last year, an increase of 20% on the previous year. The vast majority of those desperately reaching out for support are young people. Due to growing public debt, EU governments have been cutting investment in crucial areas such as education.
That cannot be the right way forward. We are increasingly in a knowledge economy in Europe. We need to invest in our people to really be competitive.
The potential fallout from a conflict between Western-backed Ukraine and Russia is fueling economic uncertainty in the EU.
This is something we have to factor into our economic analysis. And geopolitical tensions and issues, of course, have to be recognised.
Some EU lawmakers say the West should stop provoking Russia and instead put the best interests of citizens first. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
France's ambassador to Mali has been kicked out of the country in a major blow to the neo-colonial sphere of influence known as France-Afrique. The reasons included undiplomatic language from Paris towards a new military government in the capital of Bamako, but also sanctions on Mali, which have raised food prices, and especially the failure of almost a decade of French-led war. France first declared war in overwhelmingly Muslim Mali without the United Nations' approval, allegedly to fight religious extremists. 9 years later, with thousands dead and a million refugees, public opinion has turned massively against France.
Polls show that 80% of Malians in the capital think that France was only there to defend French interests. It's an opinion which Paris has blamed on Russian disinformation.
Public opinion is also reportedly strongly supportive of expelling the French ambassador, as well as of the military.
Dans la vision occidentale,
in the Western vision of things, there isn't a desire to respect the majority will of these people, or to help install a minimum of democracy, and thus a government with a minimum of credibility. If you install a government which is pro-Western and which doesn't reflect the popular will, then of course you will create anti-occupation sentiment because you become a hostile force yourself.
The bold move by Mali comes just days after Burkina Faso's military seized the heads of state, even as French soldiers were on a mission in the country. In the past 18 months, other revolts in Guinea as well as in Chad and Niger have many wondering if France is losing its neo-colonial hold on sub-Saharan Africa.
Les intérêts français dans la région.
France's interests in the region are threatened by new players such as China, Russia, and even Qatar, which has invested a lot there. We can no longer say this is a region which is under total French domination, because there is now competition. However, as long as the local governments are corrupt, they can be easily influenced by foreign powers.
France's military has stalled for time, saying a total military withdrawal from Mali will be discussed in the coming days. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip staged a rally organized by the Women Framework of the Islamic Jihad movement to voice their support for Palestinians in Negev region in southern parts of the occupied Palestinian territories. The protesters denounced the Israeli regime for violating the rights of locals in Negev and demolishing their homes.
We are here today to support Palestinians in Negev. Israeli regime is trying to demolish our identity by taking over these lands and expelling the Palestinians. Our message is that we will never accept such crimes. All the Palestinians are facing the same struggle, and we will remain united.
In recent days, hundreds of Palestinians in Negev have staged protests against their land confiscation by the so-called Jewish National Fund, an organization that collects money from Jews around the world to seize the Palestinian property. The Israeli regime has suppressed the demonstrations, arresting dozens of Palestinians.
Israel has stolen all what is Palestinian for a long time, but our Palestinian resistance keep defending the Palestinian rights by all means, even the armed resistance. Our enemy used every possible chance to press ahead with its apartheid policies of land grabbing, but our national resistance never hesitate to fight in the face of these crimes in all parts of Palestine.
Palestinians are all united in the face of the Israeli occupation and reject as illegal and unacceptable the Israeli land grab policy.
This event is held to voice our support for Palestinians in Negev who are under Israeli illegal land grab policy. This Israeli regime is expelling Palestinians from their lands and replacing them with settlers. We tell them that we maintain our unity and fight back, while we urge the international community to take a serious step to end such crimes.
The number of Palestinians in Negev is estimated at 300,000. Estimates show that they are living on 5% of the land, 95% of which confiscated by Israel. Israel has seized more Palestinian lands in Nakab in the past few years. Protesters here say this is an attempt to expel the Palestinian population from the area, which amounts to crime against humanity. They also stress that Palestinians in Nakab are not alone in their struggle. Ruba Shabet,
Gaza.
Iran's biggest cinematic event, the 40th edition of Fajr Film Festival, is underway, playing host to high-profile Iranian filmmakers, critics, and cineasts in Iran's iconic Milad Tower. The annual event rolled down the red carpet for the first time in 2 years, as the festival was held with limited presence last year.
Fajr Film Festival was held without public presence last year due to the pandemic. But this year, we decided to hold it with health protocols in place. Some 61 movie theaters across the country are screening the participating films. That's around 14,000 chairs. But the halls run with 50% of their capacities to comply with the health protocols. Filmgoers are required to show their vaccination card with at least 2 doses. We have also set up vaccination booths for those who have not got their third jabs.
A lineup of 22 films, mostly made by the new generation of Iranian filmmakers, are competing for a Crystal Simorgh as the top prize of the festival. Among the competing films is Murtaza Ali Abbas Mirzai's Beirut, a sport drama on the life of Iranian goalkeeper Ali Raza Behrahmand, who made a name for himself after catching Cristiano Ronaldo's penalty kick, The Loser Man by Mohammad Hossein Mahdavian, and The Situation of Mehdi by Hadi Hejazifar are other highlights of the lineup. After each film is screened, the cast and crew attend a Q&A session with journalists and cineasts.
Fajr Film Festival provides professional and specialized feedbacks on our performance as actors and filmmakers. And it's such criticisms and feedbacks that make us find our deficiencies and try to improve.
Recently, an important and new development has taken place in Fajr Film Festival, and that is the festival is no longer specific for veteran filmmakers, and we see that younger but talented filmmakers also participate and win a prize, so it's changing the film industry for the better.
10 memorable films from renowned Iranian directors will be reviewed in the Classics Preserved section of the Fajr Film Festival. Among them is Abbas Kiarostami's 1987 Where's the Friend's House and Majid Majidi's 1999 Oscar-nominated film Children of Heaven. Fajr Film Festival is held every year on the anniversary of the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. The 40th edition of the 10-day event kicked off on February 1st and will wrap up with the announcement of winners on February 11th.
Fajr Film Festival is Iran's most iconic cinematic event, and the movies that win a Crystal Simorgh will go down in the list of Iran's blockbusters. This makes it a tough competition among the participating films, so they all must be worthy of watching on the big screen. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
More than a dozen colleges and universities in many U.S. cities, from Baltimore to New Orleans, had to lock down or suspend classes as they received threats of bombing and mass shooting. That's on the first day of Black History Month, a time